FM News Talk 97.1. On-demand audio.
Joined now by the Republican National Committee's National Press Secretary, Cassie. I'm going to make sure I get this right. Smedley, hey, good talking to you.
You got it. Great to be with you guys.
Okay, so you don't have anything going on as press secretary or any media inquiries going on right now, right?
No, it's pretty quiet. that summer break, you know. No, it's never a dull moment, but fortunately, it's a really good mix of a lot of good news to tout. And yeah, there are some annoying inquiries too, but we've got a lot of good things out there.
Yeah, and those are the things. We talked about that earlier. Every talk show gets all kinds of phone calls, you know, and I know you're not going to, you know, probably say a lot about this, but, you know, I've worked in communications. I've worked for a former congressman. And, you know, there are times when something happens. Of course, when I worked for the former congressman, we didn't have Twitter back then. So there are times when the tweets happen that I know people on the staff have to just cringe. But let me ask you this, because I know I've been around comms long enough to know that you're not going to probably answer that question. You can't. But let me ask you this. When we have debates over what did the president mean when he said, you know, should go back to the country where they came from, when people are chanting, send her back, we were talking earlier about, I would much rather be talking about tax cuts and what it's done for me, but we're not in a position to do that because of these constant blow-ups over things like the squad and over things like the accusations of racism and things like that. I mean, how do we get the conversation back to actual policy? Because right now, I am losing hope that that's ever going to happen.
Well, it's interesting to talk about Twitter. I worked on Capitol Hill, for 10 years as well. And I always think, you know, these things happen all the time. We just didn't have Twitter to give us the greatest gift of blowing it all out of proportion, which is what Twitter does. You know, we're not living in such unprecedented times from that perspective. But you're right, we are in pretty unprecedented times from the economic perspective. And people do want to talk about that. That is what we see in our data, that people care about when they go vote. It's a vote on the economy. It's not the vote on impeachment proceedings or the Mueller investigation. And so we are trying always to focus it in that direction. I know the president, when he does these rallies, you have the media, what the media zones in on, and then you've got the rest of the rally where they are talking about the results. And certainly as we get closer to this election and you start, the media has to focus on the 2020 Democrats. If you notice, there's been no talk about them virtually over the last couple of weeks because the squad takes all the oxygen. But when they get back on stage in Detroit, we're going to get more opportunities to see how they want to take more of our taxpayer dollars to create more government programs, to have more control of our lives. That will be back on full display. That will be back in front. And expect the president, I know his favorite thing to do is to compare how his free market approach, his free market, you in charge of your life, you in charge of your American dream approach, has produced some of the greatest results this country has ever seen versus their government takes all, controls all strategy. So we're going to get back to this, whether the mainstream media likes it or not, very quickly once we have those debates coming up in just a few days.
Cassie, you mentioned the squad, and I think it's fascinating over the last couple of weeks, the internal division between the squad and the Speaker Pelosi and some of the more established, and I don't mean this pejoratively, politicians, because there is a such thing as political science, but when your enemy is self-destructing and fighting amongst itself, why jump in the middle of it? I mean, why not just let them continue to circle the firing squad?
Well, I think there's a lot of that too. And certainly what's interesting though, and I think what's frustrating to Democrats, you know, people wouldn't believe it, but in DC, we live next door to Democrats and Republicans, and we sit and chat as we're heading out to our cars in the morning, is that it's very frustrating to them that they see what's happening in their party, because I live across the street from a Democrat who works for a member of Congress who is a freshman that lives in a district that Donald Trump won in 2016. And they're frustrated because they're not able to get anything done. They didn't run on being some far-left radical like an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That doesn't match their district. They ran on being a pragmatic person who would work with Donald Trump when it made sense. And unfortunately, the, quote, squad has not allowed them to have many, if any, opportunities to do that, at least not in a meaningful way. So that spells trouble for them in 2020, and they're very aware of it.
Yeah, there's just no discussion of policy along these things. Let me let you respond to something Vice President Biden had to say when he was asked about this and latest blow up. Let's go to cut five, please.
Who was it? Jefferson's? Who was it? A general statue, a Confederate general. Well, he must be blind and deaf, because if he didn't hear what they were saying, then I don't understand it. Look, this is a game. This is about dividing the country. This is about dividing and raising the issue of racism across the country, because that's his base. That's what he's been pushing.
That's his base, Cassie.
Well, I had a little trouble hearing what he was saying, but if you didn't hear it, well, Joe Biden, he gets about 200 people at an event. And if you've ever been to one of those rallies, they're really loud, so things take a second. But no, what is the base in the Democrat Party? The base in the Democrat Party is now these four women who never shy away from saying disparaging comments about our president, from saying disparaging comments about the men and women who protect our borders, from saying disparaging comments. I mean, to have Ilhan Omar downplay Al-Qaeda and say that 9/11 was the U.S.'s fault, that is an astounding statement, especially to my generation. Those are my friends. That was my siblings who went over and fought for our country after 9/11 and against Al-Qaeda. That's the comments that they are making, and that's the comments that their side is embracing. And that is the frustration that you hear. Certainly, we don't agree with the chant at the rally, but across the board, when you're talking to people, they say, it's frustrating to me that there is this double standard, that every single day the media goes out and attacks our president. That's their full-time job, despite the fact that there are real results in this country that mean a lot to people. And then they go out and they attack our country and they attack our president, and they seem to get another magazine cover. The double standard is not fair, and it's very frustrating to America-loving people who go out every day and we work hard and we try and do right by our family and communities, to hear these other people get so much attention for comments that seem so out of step with not only the reality in our country right now, but the values and patriotism that so many of us hold so closely to our hearts.
We're visiting with Cassie Smedley, the National Press Secretary for the Republican National Committee. Cassie, you bring up an interesting point. I mean, obviously, we know that overall media has not been fair to the president. Now, there have been times the president, I think, has kind of brought some of the attention on himself for tweets that just make people cringe and statements. But when you talk about, for instance, you just mentioned, you know, you didn't like, you know, the chant at the rally. That is a terrible look. From a communications perspective, I understand the president's disavowed it. But, you know, he was saying they should go back to where they came from, which was not well advised, in my opinion. But the crowd, when they do like that, what's the message to the Republican base when it comes to the right mindset and the right actions and the right words when we're going into the presidential election?
Right. Well, for our part at the RNC, we work closely with the president's campaign and all Republicans. We have a model that's out in the country, that's out in the states, in your neighborhood. If you're going to be contacted to talk about how you're going to vote or volunteer or register to vote, chances are be by someone who lives in your neighborhood. And so those conversations are going to be based on what's happening closest to home for you. And that's really what elections are going to be about. Try as anyone might to make it about a tweet or something that happened at a rally. First of all, we're a long way off from an election. But secondly, we know that most people, as they saw in 2015, say, oh, yeah, the tweet. I mean, I heard the president say this. I was in a pretty small event with him, and it was kind of a humbling moment, I guess, for him, where he said, you know, I get people all the time who say, you know, I don't love all the tweets, but I love that we hear directly from you. So I'll give you credit for that. And say, you know, I don't love all the tweets, but I love the results, and I love that you stood up for the things that you said you were going to do. And so therefore, you know, I didn't vote for you in 2016, but I'm voting for you in 2020. And we hear that all the time, because at the end of the day, you're voting on results. We tried the personality president with Barack Obama, and look where it got us. We want a results-driven president. And I think, especially when you compare it to the field of Democrats, we'll take any of them. When you put whoever their eventual nominee is on stage with President Trump, all it's going to be is results versus their more, I think, across the board, socialist efforts to get more government control over your life. It's going to be a very stark choice, and we think we know where people are going to go, because things are going well.
Cassie, let me shift gears just a little bit. How much of the 2020 campaign will be or should be about the Supreme Court and about federal judges? Because there are a lot of judges getting appointed right now, and the possibility of at least one more Supreme Court justice, maybe after the election, but possibly before the election.
I'm so glad you brought that up. We know that this was the number one issue that drove undecided Republicans to vote for President Trump in 2016, and that has remained. And in a lot of states, there are significant Supreme Court justice races in 2020 as well that are going to state Supreme Court justice races that are going to affect the balance of at the state level. So we're kind of harboring that same enthusiasm and passion for appointing constitutional judges to the courts in 2016. And you better believe that's absolutely part of the grassroots strategy in those conversations, because when you start talking about the Supreme Court and judges, and the certainly Mitch McConnell calls it the greatest accomplishment of his career, and I think it will go down as the greatest accomplishment of President Trump's career, certainly one of them. That issue, again, is off the charts. People are very concerned about that. They see what happens in areas like the Ninth Circuit Court, where liberals love to send every complaint. And we have a real opportunity to correct the course in the courts. And I think that's going to drive people to the polls. It's a great point.
What's the message to those in the middle? Because I think personally, and this is not me as a right of center guy talking, this is just me as kind of a political observer from over the years. It seems to me, and I talked to Henry Olson from the Washington Post about this a month or two ago. He said, you know, I don't think that this is Henry talking. He said, I don't think that the current set of standard bearers for the Democratic Party, which would be the candidates and obviously Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. He said, I think they are so farther to the left than the mainstream Democratic voter, especially in the Midwest, maybe not on the coast. He says, but he believes that there are people in the middle, not just independents, but even center left Democrats who might be up for winning by Republican votes. Are you seeing that anywhere in the country? Obviously, you want every vote you could get, but diehard Democrats, particularly here in flyover country, may be feeling disconnected to their standard bearers right now.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, a very underreported note is at the rallies, very often half the crowd is registered Democrats. And very often from that, now that number is shrinking because we see a lot of return folks from 2016. But often from that, I would say at least half of those folks are checking things out for the first time because they are pretty disenfranchised from the left. And even when you see Joe Biden flip-flop on his support of the Hyde Amendment, which of course would ban taxpayer dollars from going to fund abortion, and now he says that's okay and in fact that's necessary. Joe Biden, who is supposed to be the moderate saving grace, that's no longer the case. They do not have a moderate option on the left today. And that is, I think, very troubling for folks. And then you counter that with what's happening with President Trump, and he is going, I'm a Kansas City girl, so I also am from flyover country, and he goes there, and he has not forgotten us, people that we have felt that we hadn't been talked to in a long time. And he says, what's going on here? And let's talk about whether it's manufacturing, or yes, whether it's agriculture, or trying to get the USMCA passed, or talking about First Step Act, and then the Second Chance and Opportunity Zones, and so many of our more rural communities across the country. That type of attention means something to folks, and it's producing results. It's producing the greatest economic boom, arguably, in our country's history. And that's having a real impact on just day-to-day decisions in our lives. And there's no alternative on the left right now. It just does not exist. For them, they say, oh, you've got some extra money in your pocket? I'll take that. I got a government program I can use that for. And I just don't know why we would ever take the risk on one of them to send this backwards and undo all of this good stuff that's been happening.
Okay, let me follow up with that and maybe actually ask more about Congress than even the president here. We talk about the economic boom that's happening, and I'm feeling it. I mean, I'm taking home more because of tax cuts. I was able actually to go back into business for myself in large part because of that policy. But we still have near or at record spending deficits because we're not cutting spending. I mean, the tax cuts need to be offset with lower spending. Why can't we get Republicans to cut actual spending and actually say, listen, we got to reduce the size of government with spending. I mean, it's one of those things where Republicans were in a position to do it when they had all three branches of government, or not all three branches, but when they had the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And that's one of the criticisms I think Republicans at the Senate and at the House level are going to get, is to say, listen, you talk about smaller government, so spend less money.
Right. Well, I think, everybody out there wants to do it. One dirty little secret of the Obama administration is that when they had control of Congress and the White House, they made a lot of their big government proposals. They did it under the guise of mandatory spending. You know how hard, Congress, for your listeners, it's mandatory spending versus discretionary spending. So mandatory spending is things like now Obamacare and defense and all of the entitlements, the Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And then they added in all of these other things that they put under mandatory spending. And so the pot of the money that you can actually cut is smaller, and it's a lot harder to touch the mandatory spending. The legislative process, you gotta get a lot more friends on the other side to join you. And so when you're having all of these other battles, it's really hard to get that process going. Now, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be a priority. I think everyone would agree. But it's just a little harder to do that. And so that's why when you see things like what President Trump is doing to the administration of cutting the regulations and trying to get rid of some of the ancillary costs in just the paperwork of things, those are ways that you can start to chip away at it. But we need a total overhaul of how our spending structure is set up, because there's so much that when you try and touch it, then you're the next out of throwing grandma in a wheelchair over a cliff, when that's not the case. But things are so heightened and attention spans are so short for understanding how we really need to go about doing it in the way that's meaningful but also does not hurt folks, certainly unintentionally.
All right, Cassie.
And that gets really politically hard to do.
Yeah, we've got the news coming up here. Thanks so much for the update. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Get more at 971talk.com.